Welcome to Marketing Tips for Translators, a podcast with marketing and business tips and strategy specifically for freelance translators and interpreters. I'm your host, Tess Whitty, a longtime freelance translator with an education and professional background in marketing. Tune in to hear tips from my own experience or from other translators and industry experts. Hi there, this is Tess with a quick note. If you're listening to this episode just as it's released, you know that we are in the middle of an unprecedented pandemic that's changing everything in our lives and businesses. And I truly hope you and your loved ones are healthy and safe. This episode was recorded before the pandemic changed the world, and I want to keep providing you with marketing and business tips as usual. I also want to go back to providing normal content, since many of you might be inundated with or tired of hearing about the COVID-19 right now. However, if you're subscribed to my newsletter, you will also get useful tips and resources on how to handle this pandemic, how to market right now, and much more. Now, let's get on with the show. This episode is sponsored by TransPDF. TransPDF converts your PDF files into high-quality XLIF files that are ready for translation using your own tools. Then it uses your translated XLIF to make a finished PDF with all the layout and style of the original. TransPDF also handles scanned PDFs, integrates it with MemoQ, MemSource, and OnTram, and it includes free use of Infix PDF Editor for any last-minute changes to your translated PDFs. So I would encourage you to go check it out. You can get your free TransPDF account now and try it for yourself at transpdf.icenai.com, and I will put a link to this in the show notes. And there are special offers available for pros users. Welcome to Marketing Tips for Translators. I'm so happy you're here again for another episode. Or if you're brand new, this is where you learn business and marketing tips for a successful freelance career. Now, today we're going to talk about how to successfully get started as a freelance translator or interpreter. You don't need magic tricks, you only need the right information. And many of us have a degree in translation, linguistics, or interpreting. We have spent years at a university, or we are transitioning from another career, and we just don't have the information on how to get started. Between a person who loves languages and a person who makes a living out of it, there is just one difference. The latter has learned how to do it, how to run a business, and if other people have learned it, so can you. So in this episode, I am interviewing two veteran translators and interpreters by now, who frequently present on how to get started as freelancers, and they will share their best business tips here. But before I welcome them, a shout out to one of the listeners. This one goes to El Daniel from Peru. And he or she says, "This podcast is great. It not only complements formal and informal translation education, it also presents ideas and resources that we can easily use. It's definitely worth it. Thank you so much for taking the time to leave this review. And I am so happy you like it." Now let's welcome Valeria Aliperta and Vasiliki Prestige to the podcast. Welcome, Valeria and Vasiliki.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, everyone.
How are you?
Very well. We're just excited to be here with you again.
Yes,
really. I'm very
well.
Happy to
have you.
I'm very happy to have you on the phone, and I really like meeting you in person, but it's having you on the phone is a good alternative.
Just the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah.
We are in the same room, for that's also quite good.
I'm sorry?
We are in the same room, so two of us are.
Yes, I know. So, for people who don't know you, can you tell us briefly about your career in translation and interpretation and why you are presenting on this topic? Should we start with Valeria today?
All right. Okay, well, basically I've been freelancing since the best part of 2006, I would say, working as a first job as a freelancer. So I've never worked in anything else. And I do talk about how to become a freelancer simply because nobody told me how back in the day. Okay. So I find that that's a very good thing to talk about for people who have doubts or people who don't know how to do or how to start in something they really like. And yeah, so my languages are Italian, Spanish, and English, and I basically do a bit of everything, mostly conference interpreting, but I also tutor at university, and I copyright, I'm a speaker on branding, social media, mostly I like creative text, I do consultancy and interpreting all around Europe and the US at the moment as well. So when I'm not busy working, which is most of the time, I also like to keep my blog, The Stylish Freelancer, which is just related on related to lifestyle and fashion and luxury items, which is also one of my specialties as a translator.
So how much would you say you interpret and how much do you translate percentage-wise?
It's really seasonal for me. So I have months where I'm very busy doing interpreting and mainly February, March, April, May, and then September, October, November. So the rest of the months, I try to fit it in with lots of other bits and pieces, translation, editing, copy, so anything that can go along remotely. So mostly December and January, I rarely interpret because people don't normally have conferences or meetings. So those are the months where I try to do most of the other stuff. Yeah. So I would say it depends. It could be 50-50 or 70-30. Really depends, but it's seasonal. Yeah.
Okay. And what about you, Vasiliki?
So I've been freelancing since 2010, but for the first 5 years, I had full-time jobs in parallel with my freelancing because I wanted to slowly build up the business and the client base. But all my contracting roles within companies were related to translation. So I did a lot of translation project management and then localization, QA testing, and I've had a few consulting roles in as an in-house linguist. And then I decided that I was ready and to take, you know, the opportunity and to take the risk and become a full-time freelance translator and interpreter. And it's been going great ever since. I do translation, interpreting and transcreation. And I specialize mainly in legal marketing and psychometrics translation. And I've recently started working as a university lecturer in legal translation at London and University here in London, which is very exciting and interesting, and it actually helps me learn more than teach perhaps sometimes, because it takes a lot of studying and preparing, which is fun and interesting. And I also have a blog, and I try to write at least an article every month. And I didn't mention my languages, did I? Yeah, I work with
surprisingly Greek.
Yes, I work from English into Greek and a little Greek into English, and then my third language pair is French into Greek, but it's very very small at the moment. And my main language pair, of course, is English into Greek.
And what about you? Would you? How much do you? Would you say percentage-wise you do translation and how much do you do interpreting?
So ever since I've moved to London, which was last year sometime in September, my interpreting work has in fact increased And I was, before, perhaps I was getting 1 to 2 assignments every month. Now it's at around 5 interpreting assignments every month. And I find that it's in cities outside London as well. So Leeds, Birmingham, Dorset. And so it's increasing. But I would say maybe 70-30 or 65-35, something like that at the moment. But I'm also finding that I'm getting a few other kind of hybrid roles, which are, you know, a day working in a client's offices, doing something in between creative writing and transcreation on the spot, which, and a little bit of interpreting during a phone call. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing this developing trend, maybe at least in my language pair, where people are asking for more of a hybrid linguist role with a variety of different, with, you know, a wider skill set, because they don't just want a translator, they want more of a consultant.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So yeah, it's they're definitely fun jobs to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are plenty of things that are kind of spinning off, you know, or out of the classic profile as a pure linguist, which is funny because sometimes linguist is such a broad term, and it could be a computational linguist, it could be a pure linguist, it could be simply an expert on language, it could be so many things. And especially tech companies are trying to find, you know, people who can do languages for various purposes. So,
and would you think this is location based?
I think so. I mean, for it has been location-based, mm-hmm. Yes.
If you're talking simply about interpreting, it really depends. The type of interpreting that I do, which is mostly in the booth, could be anywhere in Europe or abroad. It doesn't have to be London.
I mean the hybrid services.
But the hybrid roles could be remote as well. Sometimes they depend on location, but it mostly depends on the field that you provide services to. Yeah.
I would say it depends on location, at least in my case, because, you know, very often they look at the profile and where you are. And if you are where the client is, you know, very close proximity, then I think they would go for you. But then also what I've been told recently by a client was that they chose me for this interesting consulting role because they saw that I do a lot of public speaking and they wanted somebody who is, you know, easy to talk with and can actually communicate really well and be able to present and stand in front of a group of people and talk. Mm-hmm. So I think they're looking, perhaps they're also looking at the soft skills.
Speaking about public speaking, you gave a presentation at the language show in London, and this is basically what I'm basing this interview on, because you were talking about business tips for new translators or freelancers in general, right?
Yeah, that's right, yes.
And you talked about how to kick ass. According to you, what is required to become a successful freelancer and to kick ass?
Well, that's a bit of a joke that I always like to put up in the slides, because people get a bit comfy when, you know, the audience open up a bit and they just feel like I'm not way too serious for them. So make you more approachable. But yeah, ultimately, that's what I believe. You just kind of need to
I think the slide was be willing to kick ass.
Yeah, you know? Need to be willing to go beyond, you know, to go the extra mile and find the will to do things that are needed for your business. So you just can't sit there, rest on laurels and say, okay, now, you know, come to me, or you'll find. So in a way, yeah, you need to be found, but of course you need to be willing to sort of work your ass off. Keep the analogy, really, you pardon my French, but basically, yeah, will is not everything, but it does help if you know what you want to do, and you're half of the way there, I think.
So if we start from the beginning, then what do you need to get started or to set up shop, so to speak?
So, yes, this is a very perhaps sort of local dependent question, because if we're about practicalities and finances, it depends which country you're based at. I would say, at least from my experience, it took me a while to say I am doing this 100% full time. Mm-hmm. And when I did start doing it, what I felt that I needed was to have various things in place. And by things, I mean a good website, perhaps some good online presence, at least your social media and a decent mm-hmm. LinkedIn profile, your good business cards at hand and ready mm-hmm. to give to people. And in terms of practicalities, of course, being aware of what it is that you need to do around taxes and accounting and your finances. Yeah. So you need to register as a business or a sole trader, or do you have an accountant? Do you need one? Which is the authority you have to register with? What are the regulations? And then also, I think, perhaps have a plan B, or be aware of the fact that things might not kick off straight from the start, and ensure you have some savings perhaps on the side, because what are you going to do if things don't work very well at the first few months? I think I was reading a book, or what I think it was a podcast actually, how to transition from a full-time job into a freelance or a business owner. Mm-hmm. And the general advice was that you need at least 6 months' wages in the bank account as a safety net.
That's in the ideal
world. Of course, this is in the ideal world. And whatever 6 months' salaries means to everyone is very different, right?
Especially, in my specific case, I didn't have a job before. So that's literally what I started to do from day one after graduation. So it's all nice and dandy, but I didn't have a website. I barely had a business card with my name on it. I barely had a phone number to call. So the very first thing that I can suggest you should do is check with the financial authority and just register as a sole trader, the simplest level, the simplest threshold that you can register at, and then from there, open a bank account and just be sure that you can issue an invoice as basic as it is and just be paid. So that's the main point, the main starting point. Of course, you'll need to
I also think it's different. Getting started can be, you can do it like Vasiliki did. You transition slowly from being employed to being a freelancer, right? And Valeria, you started from graduating, and I suspect that if you are studying languages or translation or interpreting, you can start a little bit before graduation. And then you also have the situation that I was in. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, and I slowly built my business that way. So there are different venues to do this, but yes, one of the most important things to do is to open a bank account for your business, and not having your private account for your business, and to register as a company.
And also, I found that I didn't even have a desk at the time. So that's also another good point. If you have a space, be it the kitchen or wherever you want, it doesn't have to be a separate room. But at the time, we didn't even have a desk. So I was working on my lap, literally. Mm-hmm. So a good machine, maybe a table, and that's all you need in the very first 2 weeks, I would say. And then you can just take it from there. I know it sounds very basic, but that's the reality of it. If you have a reliable machine, a reliable laptop, and good connection, and a phone, you can do wonders in that first 2 weeks, I guess.
And what about marketing when you first start out? Do you have any top tips on that? And marketing and getting your first clients. How did you two get your first clients, for example?
Funnily enough, it's something that comes from your family, or at least it was for me, through friends and people who needed, some kind of help. It could be, at first it could have been charity, at first it could have been simply just a favor, but then like that I found what I was good at, I found out the way I was working, so how much time I would need to do some things or how much time would I need to do some others. So in the beginning it was just like that, sort of a very basic word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I started creating. Well, at the time we had no Twitter. So as soon as Twitter was up, you know, social media increased presence, and that was easier at the time because nobody wasn't there. So at the high time of Twitter, I was one of the most, you know, active Twitter translators in 2008 or something. So it was much easier to sort of do your marketing because nobody knew how to do it. So now it's much different, and everybody has a good website, everybody has a good business card, and, you know, to a certain degree, you still need to have a marketing strategy, but, you know, an initiative and willingness to kick ass. But the best tip probably is to just try and find out what your entourage may need, and from there are the contacts, and from there are the networking. And one thing that really helped at the time was joining an association where I met other people. So it's basic steps, and it doesn't give you a client every month for 6 months, obviously, because the first month I was barely making, you know, £300 or £400 a month. But, you know, that's the start, and you just then meet other people and other colleagues, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
How long would you say it took you, Valeria, to build a sustainable business that you could, like...
I would say 6 months to 9 months.
Okay.
To get it going.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to say, oh, I could pay rent. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
What about you, Vasiliki? How did you get your first clients, and what do you think new translators should do?
I had a very similar story, I think. So during my university, during my master's degree, and during the summer I was writing my thesis, I started slowly sending my CV to various agencies, and most of them actually contacted me for interpreting jobs, and that started. I started with very small public service interpreting jobs, and then a family member said, oh, I need something for Greece. Can you do it? And I said, yes. And I did it. And then they said, oh, we have a friend now who needs something. Can you do it? And then I did it. And then with word of mouth, I started getting a few little jobs here and there. And then what happened for me was that I did, immediately after my MA, a very short course on localization and multimedia, which was about video game localization, app localization, and website localization and testing. And then it was completely accidentally a job advertised for a Greek localization QA tester for video games and for films, and it was essentially in the film industry, and it was a contracting job, so it kept me quite busy for the first couple of months, and then they let me go because the project was finished. But within my thing, I was pushed quite a lot, and I was having some steady income in a way for the first, you know, 2 or 3 months, and I've used it to build upon it. But I think then I got quite tired with the interpreting jobs because I lived in London, I was very young, and the interpreting market was crashing at the time. It was 2010-11, where a lot of things were going wrong within the public service interpreting sphere in the UK. And I was quite disappointed, and I thought perhaps I should get some in-house experience first and continue doing this on the side until I feel a bit better. But essentially, this is how I got started, and I think there was another part to your question that I haven't answered.
What do you recommend other freshly graduated students should do to market their businesses in the beginning?
Yes, I think it's very tough, but try not to give into doing absolutely everything and going to all the events or advertising your services everywhere. Try and figure out perhaps what niche area you might want to follow. I know it's very difficult at the beginning to know what you want to specialize in, but if you do have an idea based on what you like or what you enjoy translating or any previous experience you may have that in a way informs you better to specialize into an area. Let's say you were working in a shop that was selling like athleisure, you know, out clothing for sports. So perhaps little bit about that area. So in a way that you can leverage that knowledge and build a specialization on it. So, you know, think a little bit differently and definitely go to networking events, because I also got a few jobs at the beginning because I met people that then recommended me to their clients.
Especially depending on where you're based. Some of the languages that are considered more rare in some areas, maybe you meet people that actually they never have met someone who does Italian or Greek. Mm-hmm. So I recently went to the ATA, as you know, conference in Palm Springs, and I actually pretty much didn't meet anyone else that did Italian, maybe 2-3 people, you know. So mm-hmm. depends on the area, what the conference is or what the event is, and maybe sometimes, you know, people will just remember you because you're the only Greek they know, or you're the only Italian they've met, or
so you're
the
only one. When you talk about networking, you mean translation and interpretation related events?
No, not necessarily. No.
I think at the beginning I was going to translation and interpreting networking events, and the referrals I got were from other translators and interpreters.
Yeah.
But eventually, I think once you know where and who your clients are, then you go to the events that the clients go to because you want to get the direct clients.
Yeah, much more advanced and hard to do.
Perhaps it comes a bit later in the process.
Yeah, especially in the beginning, you know nothing about how to be. I mean, unless you're like a natural born networker, which some people are, I have to say, it's very odd to just walk in a room and ask questions to others, you know. Yeah. So it's always good to go with somebody that you know or that have got the same goals, possibly not the same languages, it's better. But, you know, it helps you be more interesting for people you meet. And then, you know, when you're advanced enough and you know how to approach people, then maybe you can try going to different events where you won't have the help of your entourage as other translators. So everybody will be in the same boat at those events, while in clients' events, you'll be the odd one out, really, most of the time.
So, for example, for conference interpreting, then, where would you go, Valeria?
Well, conference interpreting is very hard on networking because interpreters don't like to hang out.
And events.
How did you get your conference interpreting jobs?
Well, it's mostly through agents or through direct clients who started finding somebody for one-to-one services, and then they eventually have an event, or it's word of mouth with client I did a translation for, and then they have an event for that kind of topic, and then they realize that most of their guests don't speak Italian or English, so it eventually falls into it.
How about event management companies that they're the ones who might be sourcing the interpreters? So go to the events basically that are for event management professionals and talk to them and say, hey, have you thought about potentially hiring interpreters for your next event if you have delegates from different countries, and I can help you with figuring out the ins and outs of.
I find that for interpreting is harder to find direct clients. It's not impossible, but it's not the typical thing to do. Most of the larger companies tend to hire a service for multiple languages, and in my experience, the agents tend to have this share of the market in terms of management. So it's much easier and less of a burden for you as an interpreter to try and be in that kind of circle. But of course, depending on the size of the companies and on the client's needs, for instance, I've done 3 years as a personal interpreter of a CEO. Searching languages and try to see.
I'm sorry, Valeria, you cut out a little bit. Can you after CEO?
Yeah, so I've done, for about 3 years, I was a personal interpreter with a CEO, and that's okay. One of the other possibilities. So it's not always via other agents. So you can eventually be asked for one event and then become more of an aficionado of that company. But it all depends on the business. And I wouldn't say there is a networking event that I went to that landed me that kind of collaboration. It's more via agents, yes, in that specific case. Also, so, translations and for other services is different, yeah.
So how important is it to be a member of a professional association?
I think it's very important, particularly at the beginning, because you need to have a place to ask questions. You need to be able to find other people that do the same job as you do so that you can talk about problems you have or questions you have. Associations also offer other benefits, such as, you know, discounts for various things. Maybe your computer or your software, your translation software, maybe you can get a discount for it. Or they offer business insurance rates that might be a bit more favorable. They can offer things like mentoring or coaching or a legal helpline. Networking events. So I think and also it's a good thing to have after your name that you are accredited by the in essence perhaps the regulating authority of the job or of the profession in your country, even though our job is not really, you know, strictly speaking a regulated profession.
I think
important clients, and especially government, perhaps if you want to work for the government, they will know about the institutes and they will look at the lists that are published online, and that's where they go to find people.
So that's what I was going to say.
The database
or the registry is also very important to find clients.
Because people find me from there all the time. And it's essentially a stamp of approval in a way. And it can, you know, differentiate you from others who perhaps are not registered.
Sometimes it's just a matter for the client to have peace of mind. So it doesn't really say that I'm a better translator if I join ATA or CIOL or whatever else we can think of. But in the mind of the buyer, it makes sure that it shows that we care and that we made an effort to be part of something bigger. Pretty much the conception, and then obviously it's up to you to prove you're worth it. But in a way, I believe yes, it's a good thing to be in the beginning, you know, join the ones that you can. Even as a student, there are plenty of opportunities to do so at discounted prices, as you know.
Some of them are completely free for students to join, actually.
That way you can be on the list and you can sort of try to find out, you know, what others are looking for, even your clients. You know, maybe what they need is a good website, or maybe what they need is to see your specialization on a page, and then they can choose with a bit of a peace of mind. So.
Yeah, and I would say a good idea is to maybe try and be a member of two, and one being in the country where your mother tongue is spoken and one where your target language is spoken. I think it's a good idea so that you are informed as to what's going on in each of the two or three countries you work.
And then you can go into more specialized sections, like if you're a legal translator or if you're an interpreter, you know, you can go with Yulita or you can go with Aid.
Exactly.
Or, you know, but that will come over in time, especially when they have very strict access and entry regulations and criteria.
Yeah.
But yeah, to start with, I believe it's a good thing. All my students from university where I teach, I always recommend that they join some sort of student memberships in the beginning so that they can make the most of learning from the members' days and going to events for discounted price and so on.
So let's circle back to the marketing again. If you're just starting out, do you need a business plan or a marketing plan?
I think it's really important to have a plan. Personally, I love planning everything from week to the month to the next 3 years. But usually what most of us do at the beginning is we just don't do it. We don't plan. We don't have a business plan. We don't have a marketing strategy. We throw ourselves into all like 5,000 different directions and you lose yourself and you lose your time. So I think it's very important to have the business plan. And even if it's a big, scary word, a business plan is essentially an indicator of a direction of travel. It shows you the point A, where you are now, and point B, which is where you want to be next. And you need to figure out the route. So how are you going to get from A to B? And break that down into smaller, manageable steps. And then you have your annual targets, your monthly targets, and then your weekly targets. And those can be anything from how much money you want to be making in 3 years, what clients ideally you want to have in 3 years or 5 years, and what specializations you wish to develop within that time, or how, what other accreditations you wish to achieve within that time frame. And
it's all very nice, but some people don't have. Let me just be the devil's advocate for a second.
This is good. This is good. We're a good pair.
This is great, but you know, being someone who had no idea how to do anything and just found it, looking it up, reading, searching, asking. So you know, I did it the hard way. Of course, there were all the tools, and I just had to find them. But I didn't have any directions in university. I didn't read anything. I didn't listen to any of the Swedish podcasts before. Back in the day, I just didn't even know what the marketing plan would be or what it was or if it existed. So playing the devil's advocate, what if a person is completely at loss? I found people, I found students who didn't even know how to compile an invoice. They had no idea what it has to be in one. Mm-hmm. So starting with that, planning in the next 3 years wants to make X and Y amount of money, that's a big stretch for someone who, you know, maybe is 22 and doesn't have a clue of, you know, maybe doesn't even have a credit card, you know. So that's really the situation of most people. I mean, I hope it's not, but let's be realistic, you know. Initially, I find that it's crucial to have at least an idea of what you want to be. So when people ask you, you know, what do you do? You have an elevator speech kind of idea to tell them. And that could be the start for your planning, really. Could be, okay, I want to do this. I want to help people sell, I don't know, plants in Greece. So I translate everything related to botanics and vegetables and plant growing and everything else, greenhouses and so on and so forth, so that people can make business in Greece with my translation. So that's a good starting point to see, well, how many clients will I need to pay rent, you know, in a year? So that's a very basic calculation that anybody can do, and that could be your very first 6 months, I would say.
Which I think is a plan. A business plan or a marketing plan looks different if you're a beginner, to whereas if you're established and can look further ahead. So maybe for a beginner, you can think, like you said, Valeria, how much do I need to earn? Where am I going to get my clients? How am I going to get my word out there? And go from there.
Yes. Yeah. So every month you set your own little goals. It could be, oh, I'll go to an event. Maybe some people are a bit agoraphobic and they just decide, oh, I'll try, you know, to be strong and go to an event and come out with 5 business cards. And then from there, take it to the next month. So it could be a sort of a work in progress editing of your own plan. And then at the end of the first 6 months, you can make it into a bit more of a business related or marketing related strategy.
And I think actually this is how a business plan and a marketing strategy plan, which is essentially part of your business plan, should work. It should never be stagnant, you know.
No.
You need to find a way of agile working because things change all the time. So if you realize that actually going to this travel, world travel conference fair thing hasn't given you any client leads for the past year or 2 years, then don't go again. Try something else. You have to, you know, changing tactics is very important, and you have to keep revising the plan.
Life happens, and when I first started, the very first year after, there was an economic crisis. So 2008 was possible for everyone. And even if I wanted to be hired somewhere, nobody would hire. So it was a very hard time, and you have to also factor force majeure in a way. So your plan is bound to change, is bound to evolve for the good and for the worse and for the better. Yeah.
So as a beginner then, how do you have any tips on how to stay motivated and disciplined and actually do the marketing and growing your business?
I think you need to do something other than translation to be motivated. So most of the time is related to your passion. So I find that, you know, traveling or going to museums, you know, depending on what really you like to do as a passion, it could also be related to your translations, but it's not always talking shop all the time. You need to also have other hobbies that don't have anything to do with it. I find that that's motivation for me. Some other people meditate, some other people you know, set their goals so that they can be rewarded once they achieve their goal. So it really depends on the personal approach to life, I would say. I like to change completely, you know, do nothing or do something that's not related to translation. That really helps me find a new recharge mind to then go back to my translations.
Okay. What about you, Vasiliki? If you think back at when you got started, what got you kept you motivated and disciplined to market?
I think I am one of these people who are naturally motivated and very disciplined, so I don't have to try very hard. But I think if you're at the beginning and you're not motivated or disciplined enough, I would be a little bit worried.
Maybe freelancing is not for you.
You know, because at the beginning, beginning sometimes means you're also young, but not necessarily, because you could be transitioning to another career. So if you're starting out and you really want this to work, I'm expecting somebody to be throwing themselves at it like crazy and not being able to stop. I was like that, at least, you know, working night and day and weekends and everything. But what Val said, I think, also is important, to take the time off and stop and look for inspiration elsewhere. These days I find, for example, that what keeps me motivated is that if I work really hard, then I can actually go out and have a really nice dinner. Or if I work really hard, I can go to Paris. Or if I meet my goals, I will reward myself by buying something. Or I will go and have a nice weekend and enjoy a museum and an exhibition and a lunch and yoga and brunch and a trip. And then I'm feeling fully recharged and I'm ready to really work very hard.
I mean, of course, this discipline is hard. And even after years of working, while I still like my job, it's always hard to, you know, wake up in the morning, you know, and if you're not a morning person, especially like me. So it takes a lot of willingness. But if you like what you do and you see progress, then, of course, there are days that are just a no day. And that's it. And you need to recognize it. And then sometimes I'm more productive at night. And maybe I just rested in the morning. That's why I'm not very good with office jobs. But, you know, it's a matter of finding your own flow and see how you can be disciplined, even if you're not someone prone to be super hardworking with the set time that you had on your diary. Sometimes it just doesn't happen. Sometimes there are things that are outside your control. Sometimes you're sick. Sometimes there's a storm and you can't travel. You know, so there are things that will eventually come into
your life. But I'm kind of referring to in the beginning when you don't have any clients. To keep marketing, to get those clients.
So you keep, if you feel brought down by the fact that you can't find any jobs or you can't find any work, you need to just think about why you like it and try to hang in there. It's hard in the first 6 months to a year. Maybe you're willing to do things, but it doesn't happen. And you still need to try and keep tweaking your plan. So as we said before, if that event didn't yield any result, maybe that's not the right event. So try to gauge other sort of directions, or try to find another source of possible clients, another pool of possible clients via your new contacts.
For example, what I did in the beginning, I set goals. I am also a planner, and I said, I'm going to contact this many agencies this week. And then reward myself for doing it. So that's one of the ways that I stayed motivated. And I also have some sales training in the background. I did telemarketing as a summer job one summer. Hated it, but you learn that for every no you get closer to a yes. So to me, that helped me a lot to stay motivated.
Yeah, and maybe have a good template email with your CV that you send out. Mm-hmm. Of course, every time you have to tweak it a little bit and be sure you know, you know who you're actually sending it to and what language pairs they work with and what specialization areas they work with. But it's easier if you have a good template to begin with, then you become a bit faster in approaching your clients by email if that's the mode you want to follow. Yes. But I would also say mindset is really important. You know, sometimes you just have to believe that it's going to be fine and that you're going to make it, and you just have to stay positive. And it's very hard, but you just have to believe it and perhaps take your mind away from the whole working idea and do something else and then go back to it. But you do have to come from a positive mindset, I think. And I think an entrepreneurial mindset is also very important.
It's be patient, and sometimes it's hard to keep the patience going. But I guess the old emailing all the agencies that you think are relevant is always a good idea. It's a bit of a long shot sometimes, but maybe even just try to locate them and maybe ring and inquire. That's also a good idea without going into cold calling. But yes, it's something I've definitely done, just finding, all the agencies in the area and what comes up on a specific search on Google can always, be good. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I also have a question that I think I've asked both of you before, because you've both been on the podcast before, but things change all the time. What marketing strategy is working really well for you right now? Let's start with Vasiliki this time.
You know, this is not surprising, but perhaps for some it might be. I find that not just lately, but mainly word of mouth is what has actually brought me my best and, most valuable clients. Mm-hmm. And I think the evidence of the quality of your work and who you are and how you do things speaks volumes. And it's louder than your LinkedIn post or your Facebook post or your Instagram. And I found that somebody who is very happy with my work gave my contact details to somebody else working within another organization, and then that's how they contacted me, and then that person from that department then gave my contact details to a different department, or people change jobs, remember that, so when somebody that you've been working with for a long time has been very happy with you and they move to another company, you will find that people take contacts with them new job.
Yeah.
So that has been working for me very well. And also the other marketing strategy that has been working for me very well is actually visiting client events. So finding where the clients hang out and just show up and tell them who I am and what I do. But most of the times it's about just showing up and repeating your face, so that, eventually they just feel more familiar with you.
And so for you, Vasiliki, what kind of events are those?
So because I am mostly doing legal translation and then marketing and then the psychometrics, the events where I meet clients would be where lawyers or solicitors or law firms go to network. So, for example, in a couple of weeks, there is a mock trial taking place in central London in the court, which is essentially organized for younger barristers and solicitors and various legal professionals. And I thought, I need to be in that mock trial because not only I'm going to learn about how people talk during a trial, but also because I will be surrounded by people that may potentially need my services. So that's one event, for example, or precisely because of the legal specialization that I have. In the past, there was just a networking event. It was not a workshop or a learning. Well, I did learn a few things, but they organized a tour and a networking event at the Supreme Court here in London. So I thought, okay, I'll go to that. And it was actually a fun evening. You know, we were given a tour of the court and the history of the court and what sort of interesting cases they have. And you know, I was the only translator in the room. So everybody else was a lawyer. So
The reason I'm asking then, because I got this question from somebody that they said that in the legal industry, aren't those events just closed for people in the legal profession?
No, because the ones I have been going to have been open to anyone, and you don't necessarily have to be a member of the law society, for example, in the UK, in order to attend them. There are different price scales. You know, for a member, it's, let's say, £40. For a non-member, it's £50, let's say. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of these organizations allow you to have an associate membership. So you're not necessarily a solicitor, but you can say you're a law professional in a way. So they offer different category of membership that you can access, or there are various other organizations, for example, the English Spanish legal, I don't remember the exact name of it, but there are several different branches, if you want, within a specialization field that allow other professionals to enter the field, even if they're not, let's say, doctors or lawyers or architects. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Vasiliki. What about you, Valeria? What marketing strategy works well for you right now?
Well, I cannot exclude the word of mouth, especially for people you've met, and sometimes they don't know that you do other things. So maybe you work for them with the translation and they don't know that you do interpreting. So it eventually comes like that. It seems like a chimera, but it works. So obviously you won't have word of mouth the very first day after graduation, or at least it won't work as well as after a while. Mm-hmm. But actually it is kind of independent of what you do. I mean, you need to be good to be referred, but you can't control how much referrals you get. So maybe someone's referred today and then you get business in a year. So it can't be as controlled as a mechanism that you will want it to be. While with LinkedIn, while it's still kind of outside your control, at least you can control how many things you put out and how much you write and how your presence is checked. So I recently became a premium member on LinkedIn, and while I don't spend remotely enough time as I would like on it, I still get 2 or 3 good clients a year that they just found my profile there. And based on what post and based on the experience I've listed, they found that I was a good match, and I still have some of them and we work all the time together. So I think you can control specialization and knowledge and what you put out that goes under your name or under your face, and things on the internet will stay a bit like, you know, in Vegas. Stay online and they can be retrieved and found and read again. So I talk about a lot of luxury items and luxury products and fashion, and people got to know that I do that, and I even got business via Instagram because of that. If someone texts me saying, oh, I referred you to this person because I know you know everything about beauty, so that's all the time that was done via my LinkedIn or my profile or my presence. So word of mouth is great, of course, but it's kind of out of my control in a way. So I do get some of it, you know, not all of it, via word of mouth, which is a great tool. But especially when I heard that as a beginner, I was a bit puzzled because everybody was like, oh, everything they do is word of mouth. And I was like, this is great, but nobody knows me yet. So it's
but
not.
But you can also, once you've done a job that and the client is happy, you can always remind them that to if they know anybody else that you...
You will need to eventually build your word of mouth from the start without expecting it to work wonders the next day. But it will eventually work. So that for sure. And then, try to put out what your specialization is and why people should come to you for that specific thing and not somebody else. So, that's what at the moment I'm focusing on.
Thank you very much, Valeria and Vasiliki. All great tips, and I'm sure the listeners will find them very valuable too. Working on translation and interpretation skills is vital, but if we don't know anything about business and marketing, we are going to have a hard time finding actual jobs. Whether focusing on direct clients or working for language service providers, it is important that we're willing to put ourselves out there to know our strengths and how we can help and to communicate this to potential clients, both online and offline. So Vasiliki and Valeria shared some great tips here. Where can we find out more about you, Vasiliki and Valeria?
So I have a website, which is www.grtome.com. Greek to Me translations.
And, yes, and we will put a link to this in the show notes.
Perfect. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much the same social media for me. I have pretty much everywhere my handle is Rainy London, but then my website is rainylondontranslations.com. So otherwise, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook and Twitter are where you can find me.
Thank you, guys. And thank you to the listeners for listening. If you like this episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app. And I would love to hear what you think. So you can leave me a review or share the episode with anyone else that might benefit from it. So I wish you all a great week and I will see you in the next episode. Thank you for listening to Marketing Tips for Translators. I hope you found some good tips to apply to your freelance career. If you did, a great way to show this is by leaving a review on your favorite podcast listening app or to share the episode with other colleagues. Do you have a topic, question, or a guest you would like to hear about here? Send me an email to podcast@marketingtipsfortranslators.com.